Here at LCC, we love to connect people, first and foremost with Jesus, and then with others. And with that in mind, I just want to point you out to this card that many of you may have received when you walked in. If you're new around here, we would love for you just to know what we're about. Fill it out. Let us know how we can connect with you. And if you're a regular, remember this changes every month and lets you know some of the things that are happening around here. So now we're going to get to connect with Jesus. We're going to worship together. If you would are able to stand, please join us.
Good morning. It is true, I asked for that. And this morning's first lesson is be careful what you ask for. So thank you, Brett, Todd, for all the work you did on that. That was awesome. Just a fun moment, right? Because here's the thing. It asks, like, a question that, I'll be honest, like, I wonder, wouldn't it be great if I just had $1 million? If someone just dropped it in my lap, and what would I do with it? What would you do with it if you just got a windfall? What would happen if you just got a windfall of cash? In it came. You know, you're driving by the Powerball sign, and I realize $1 million today isn't quite what it was in 1995 or whenever they wrote that that song originally came out. But like, you win the lottery. How would it fundamentally change your life? Be honest about it. How often do you think about it? How often do you think about how much money would change your life at present? Think about the things you would buy or the places you would go. Maybe it's just how much easier we feel like that having more money would make our lives in general. We wouldn't worry that much. We think we'd be happier just to knowing that we have more money in the bank. But in all honesty, I mean, we can laugh with it. It's fun. But in all honesty, how much energy and time do we put into concerning ourselves with money and how much we have or don't have, or how much what we would do if we could get our hands on more? And that's what we're going to be talking about this morning when we look at this section in Ecclesiastes, because the teacher, the writer in Ecclesiastes, he's going to talk about this. He's going to put money and the security that we think that it brings front and center. And we've been in this series in Ecclesiastes. We're a little over halfway when it comes to our time frame, but we're a little under halfway when it comes to the content of the book of Ecclesiastes. But we've been focused on hope, which is a strange thing. For those who know the book of Ecclesiastes, it's a book that really talks about how unfair life can be. It's a little dark, right? It talks about how cruel this life can be. It talks about how confusing this life can be. But the writer of Ecclesiastes, I think, is putting all of that in front of us to try and get us to understand that this life isn't all that there is. There's more than just this life and its cruelty and its confusion. But in order to do that, he's walking us through some very, very difficult things and questions. Today, we're going to be in chapters 5 and 6 in the book of Ecclesiastes. If you have a Bible, we'd love for you to turn there with us. And we'll put it on the screen as well, but what we're going to do, it's a longer chunk today. We're going to read through the whole section. We're going to read through the whole section. And I'll pause here and there to explain some things that may need explained, but it's pretty straightforward with what he's saying. And then we'll look back at it at the end and try to draw some conclusions. So we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and we're going to start in verse 8. We're going to start in verse 8, and it says this. It says, "If you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are higher still." He says, "The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields." So we're coming out of a section. Josh did a great job last week talking about like our word. Like the teacher in Ecclesiastes, he emphasizes, be careful with what you promise. Be careful with what you tell God you're going to do or not do with your vows. And now there's kind of a sharp turn in the book. There's kind of a sharp turn in the writing. And he's going to pivot to this idea that, hey, there's just an awful lot of sort of like inequity. Like there's an awful lot of people taking advantage of other people. It's the truth. It's reality. There's no point in denying it. That greed, it gives birth to all this sort of manipulation in the system. It gives birth to or a rise to like people taking advantage of systems so that they can benefit from it. And when and if they're taking advantage of the system, it's causing harm to others. And he starts off this section by saying, look, don't be surprised by that. Don't be surprised when you see people that are taken advantage of. It's just it's how things are, it's how things go. And And the person at the bottom has to give a little bit to the person above them and the person above them and the person above them. But you know what? The king always seems to get rich. The person at the top always seems to benefit from the systems. And that's where he begins this section. He says, just the rich just keep getting richer. Okay? And on he goes. Verse 10. He says this, whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. He says, this too is meaningless. Look, the love of money, he says, it's meaningless. It's empty. That word meaningless is our word that appears over 30 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. It just means it's like a mirage. Like it's empty. It appears to be useful for us, but at the end of the day, it can't provide us with what it says that it can. He goes on in verse 11. He says, as goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owners except to feast their eyes on them? The sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether they eat little or much. But as for the rich, their abundance permits them more sleep. I think he's, in the ancient world, I think he's saying more money, more problems. You know, like, hang on there. The more you have, the more you have to lose. Be satisfied with what you've got, he says. Just labor for your day's work and be happy with that. Verse 13, he says, I've seen a grievous evil under the sun. That under the sun cues us. He's talking about what just happens in the world. Not the way it should be, but the way that it just is. He says, I've seen a grievous evil under the sun. Wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners. Or wealth lost through some misfortune. So that when they have children, there is nothing left for them to inherit. Everyone comes naked from their mother's womb, and as everyone comes, so they depart. They take nothing from their toil that they can hold in their hands. He goes on, this too is a grievous evil. As everyone comes, so they depart. And what do they gain since they toil for the wind? All their days they eat in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. Catch this, right? He says, look, you can't take anything with you. It's a truism, right? There's a story from years ago about a wealthy man who had a beautiful big convertible Cadillac, and he loved that car. He loved that car so much that when he passed away, it was in his will that they dug a really big hole, and they buried him in his Cadillac, right? Which is a terrible waste of a Cadillac. Right? Here's the deal. That Cadillac means nothing to him at that point. He's not driving it anywhere. But it betrays this belief that somehow our possessions give meaning to life, and in this guy's case, even death. Even death. Let's keep reading. So he says, this is what I have observed to be good. So he's flipping the script here, right? I've seen this, and I think it's good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given them, for this is their lot. He says, look, it's kind of like the simple things. It's kind of like the simple things is what we have in our day-to-day. That's good. It's good to just go through today and let today take care of itself. Verse 19 says, moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and be happy in their toil, this is a gift of God. He says, they seldom reflect on the days of their life because God keeps them occupied with gladness of heart. He says, look, even if you do have money, even if you've got some possessions, he says that being able to enjoy the enjoyment that you can get from the things in your world, in your life, he says, even that's a gift from God. He says, that's not, he's drawing this distinction. He's saying, like, it's not that having stuff, it's not that being affluent is bad. He's saying that we've put that together, having things, possessing, we've put it together with being happy or having joy. And he's going, no, those are two separate things. They're two separate things. And when you have both, they're both a gift from God. It's not that, you know, it's easy for us to look and say, like, well, they have enough, therefore they have joy, right? And in, you know, our talk today with social science researchers, we might say, don't confuse correlation for causation. Don't think that just because there are some people who have wealth and have joy, that it's the wealth that produced the joy. He says those two things may happen side by side in some people, but it's still a gift from God. It's still a gift from God. Going on into chapter 6. Into chapter 6. The chapter break here is probably not great. Like, it's the same topic he's talking about. He said, I have seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on mankind. God gives some people wealth, possessions, and honor so that they lack nothing their hearts desire. But God does not grant them the ability to enjoy them, and strangers enjoy them instead. This is meaningless. It's empty. It's a grievous evil. A man may have 100 children and live many years. Yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and does not receive proper burial, I assume without the Cadillac, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. It comes without meaning. It departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it has more rest than does that man. That is potent, powerful hyperbole. I don't want to minimize this. Our family knows the pain of miscarriage. The teacher here in Ecclesiastes is saying that it's better off to have never been born than to go through your life amassing things, gathering things, possessing things, and never really being able to enjoy them. That life is just a treadmill of agony. It's a treadmill of being disappointed. And so he's making this statement that it's better off that life never even begins than to go through life thinking that I'm going to be happy because of all this stuff. He wraps it up with this: even if he lives 1,000 years twice over but fails to enjoy his prosperity, do not all go to the same place? Don't we all? We all die. Everyone's toil is for their mouth, yet their appetite is never satisfied. What a statement, right? Everyone's work is for their mouth, for their appetite. Like, we work, we do all this stuff to get all the things and to accumulate and amass so that we can be satisfied, but it doesn't really fill us up. It leaves us empty. It's emptiness. It's what the author and the teacher in Ecclesiastes, that the Hebrew word he uses is this word hevel or hebel. It's meaningless. It's just emptiness. Making money the purpose of our life, external security, security that just comes from all the things I believe that I can gather and amass. He says, it's never filled up. We never get to the bottom of it. We're chasing the end of a bottomless pit. It's the heart of his message here. We're looking for something. We're longing for something. We're sometimes literally putting stock in something that we believe at some point is going to satisfy the longings of our life. And the author, and he's not even giving, like, he's not giving a solution in this section. He's just simply saying, if that's your approach, don't be surprised when it fails you. And unfortunately for me, man, I still believe it. I still believe that. I just had a little bit more. Maybe not a million. Quarter million? 25% of that? I could do a lot with that. Oh, I'd give a lot of it away. I'd give so much of it away after I had, you know, taken my trip and paid off my house. And I'd give everything else away. Beneath even the way I think about that is this notion that life is better with more money. Okay? And the teacher here in Ecclesiastes, he's told us already before this, he said, I set my heart to this cause, to pursuing work and all the benefits that work gives me. And he goes, look, I've experienced it. It doesn't do the thing that we think it's going to do. Like, you know, he could say, like, I had $1 million and it was still empty. It was still empty. It was meaningless. It didn't produce for me. I still had sorrow. I still had agony. This is echoed throughout the rest of the scriptures, this idea that external security, the security that we think that money or possessions can provide, that it's empty. Look at what the author of Hebrews says. He says, keep your lives free from the love of money. It's the same, this idea of loving money. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, listen, I love this. I love the reason that's given for the command. It's not just don't love money. It's don't love money Because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you, right? What he's asking here, what he's answering here with this, the author in Hebrews, what he's saying is, who do you expect or what do you expect to take care of you? That's kind of the fundamental question, isn't it? When it comes down to it, what do I believe is going to take care of me? It's going to make sure that my life is on track, that I'm secure. What am I counting on for that? And the writer in Hebrews is saying the same thing as the author in Ecclesiastes, but he's giving us the reverse of it as well. He's saying, look, don't count on money to do it. It's not money that does it. God takes care of us. He's with us. Do we believe that? If we believe that, then it's much easier to be content with today's resources. Okay? Jesus himself says this in Matthew chapter 6. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. And let's catch this last line. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Don't read over it so quickly. It's not just, hey, don't count on money. There's something in our hearts that gets attached to money. There's something in our hearts that treasures different things. And that treasure is real, right? It's this idea that, like, all this stuff is going to fade away. It's all going to be gone, every bit of it, except what's eternal, except God himself and the life eternal with him. And so if we determine that I'm going to make my life about getting more, about amassing more for myself, we're treasuring something besides God. We're banking on it. Our hearts are resting on it. It's the foundation upon which our lives are built. And Jesus is warning us. And he's saying, look, that's not just foolishness. It's not just an exercise in futility. It's actually corrosive to our soul, to our hearts, to who we are. So the first thing that we just pick up on this, okay? The first thing we can say about money is that chasing security, money, possessions, that it's empty. The second thing I want to say is that there's a chasm or there's a gulf, there's a gap between having and enjoying, okay? There's a big difference between having and enjoying. Do you remember getting like that big gift you really wanted and it came through like a Christmas morning where you wanted the Nintendo, or that's how old I am, or like the bike or whatever, and you get it. I was thinking about this and I was remembering my first car. It was sweet. Jet black, Volkswagen Rabbit, okay? It was a two-door though. It was a two-door. So, I mean, manual, like I was racing. All four of those cylinders were doing a lot of work. Okay? Had a crank sunroof so I could let the sunshine in. I put big speakers in the back of it. It was awesome. And my dad was kind of like, my dad was a guy that he like took care of his cars. Like he was just, you know, he just took care of his cars. That's what, you know, dads do. And so, you know, he would wash his, he had a nice red Ford pickup truck. He would wash it and wax it and it would shine. It was really pretty. And so when I get this car, the car was handed to me. I didn't have to pay for it. I was a child of privilege. So all $1,500 or whatever that cost in 1991. But I've got this car, and I remember very vividly, like, we've got it. It's there. I wash it. Me and Dad, we wax it. And I remember standing on the porch in my house and looking at it and going, like, I have nowhere to go. Like, it's kind of shiny, you know. And I was, you know, super happy. I sort of stood out there, if I'm being honest, 16-year-old me, I stood out there just hoping, like, somebody I knew would drive by and see I had a car. But this is the thing, right? There's a gap between possessing something and the joy, enjoying things. So I had the thing, but nowhere to go. The scriptures say more about this. Look at what it says in Psalm 39. It says, "Surely everyone goes around like a mere phantom, like a ghost, okay? In vain they rush about, heaping up wealth without knowing whose it will finally be." Like, we gather these things, but who actually gets to enjoy what we gather together, they're asking. James in the New Testament. James writes, "Don't be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows." Like, all the, everything is a gift from God, okay? In Ecclesiastes, he said, like, don't remember this idea? Like, don't assume that just because you have stuff, you're going to enjoy it. Joy in things is equally a gift from God. It's not just that he gave me stuff. He also gives the joy. And James here is arguing and saying, he's saying, look, that your every good gift in life, if there's anything to enjoy in life, it's from the hands of God. And in chapter 16, we saw Matthew 6 and now Matthew 16, Jesus again says to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life, whoever wants to like hold on to their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone, catch this, to gain the whole world, to be on top, to have all the things? What good is it to have everything in life at your fingertips, but to forfeit your soul, to give up your soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul?" We can't buy joy. We can't buy a soul that is right with God. There's no amount of money that can do it. There's no amount of possession that's going to make us right. Jesus is reinforcing this. The last of the things I want to say is that we need to shift from effort to reception, okay? Part of what goes on in life, right? And this is, it's just, as people, we can look back as far as we want to and look around us as far as we can see. And we're going to see just some common errors in the way we think and act and live. And one of those things is that we can do enough. We can do enough. I can work hard enough that I'm going to be secure. I can be good enough that people are going to treat me the right way. I can do enough that my life is going to be taken care of. And I just have to say, okay, listen, I'm here, I'm saying those things because I'm guilty. I believe it. I believe it. I believe in the cosmic scales that if I put enough good stuff out into the world, that good stuff will come back to me. And while I'm not here to advocate, like, go be a jerk, I'm here to say when we arrange our lives and orient our lives around effort, I can do enough. I can work hard enough, make enough money that it's going to secure me. We're believing something that isn't true. It's not true. What we need to do is shift from believing that my effort is going to make me right to believing that rightness, righteousness, is nothing but a gift from God. It's why when we're talking about money, yes, but we're really talking about the gospel of the goodness of God's grace. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the real God versus false gods. And all of us are believing in some God. We all are worshiping something. It's just common for us. It's common for people to worship money. To bank, literally bank on it, to build our lives on it. And we have to move. We have to move from believing that I can amass enough, I can work hard enough, I can do all the things, to simply saying it is God who sustains my life. He will never, my bank account will go up and down, and I cannot take it with me. But God's love for me does not change. His grace and acceptance of me is fixed. And it is infinite. I cannot outspend it. It's just granted to me. This is the gospel of goodness. And when it comes into like practical things in life, listen to what Paul wrote in Philippians. He says, I'm not saying this. He's talking, he's honestly talking about our resources. I'm not saying this is our that we ought to be generous, because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. And then here's this verse that we see a lot, Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through him who gives me strength. I see a lot of, you know, athletes who put this on, you know, they have it tattooed somewhere. It's like, it's great. And I love the scripture being in front of people, but let's put it in its context. When Paul says, I can do all things through him who gives me strength, great, go win the Super Bowl. That's fantastic. But what he's really saying is, when you have nothing, can you do that? When you've lost it all, can you do that? When you don't, when it's mid-afternoon and you don't know where dinner is coming from, can you do that? And Paul says, you can do that. I've done that, Paul says. I can do that through him who gives me strength. Not my own effort, but through him, through the Lord who gives him strength. You see, what we're talking about are fakes, and money is one of the biggest fakes in all of time and history. And I want to illustrate this with by sharing about a little guy in Japan. Have you seen the orphan monkey Punch? I know, right? Punch the monkey. Punch was born in July at the Ichikawa Zoo, City Zoo in Japan, and sadly, his mother was exhausted from summer heat, and she abandoned him to kind of be on his own. So to help him survive, the zookeepers had to like hand rear him. They had to feed him by bottle and do all the things. And because they have a biological instinct, like many of us, to attach to others, okay? Punch had gone around trying to attach to the other monkeys, but as you'll see in some of the footage, that didn't work out for him. They wouldn't invite him in. So the zookeepers went to IKEA, of all places, and bought him a stuffed orangutan. See, he's trying to get in there for some hugs, and no. So the zookeepers bought him an orangutan that stood in for family. And Punch would hug the orangutan, and he would drag it around. And that orangutan became like a surrogate mother for him. There's all kinds of videos out there of Punch doing various things. I'm not endorsing any of them, but I am saying that, like, yeah, Punch, the other monkeys, we would say, like, they kind of bullied him. Like, there's somewhere he's getting thrown around pretty good. What I want to say is this, is that wealth is kind of like Punch's stuffed orangutan. Stay with me. Wealth, money, resource, it's kind of like Punch's stuffed orangutan. When we come up against things in life that aren't going the way we want, when we're trying to attach, when we're trying to find meaning, and we don't, we start to grasp at other things in life. Artificial things. Things that are there but weren't meant to really do the job. We try to replace our real longing for joy and satisfaction with, in the case this morning, with money and possessions. We want to belong. We want meaning. And we're trying to replace that with something that's fake. Okay? Something that's fake. It can't actually give back to you what it is that we think we're doing with it in the first place. Like, money can't actually give us the longing of our heart, the meaning that we're after, the purpose that we were intended for. It pretends. If we look around, we say, well, the people with money have the security. People with money have the notoriety. People with money have all the pleasure. But those are all just sort of fake. They're stuffed orangutans. They're not the real thing. The real thing is the connection with the God who says he's never going to leave us. And we put our trust in these counterfeits. So what do we do? What do we do? I want to wrap up this morning with five things. These are just five bits of advice. They're not in the Bible, okay? But I think that they're consistent with what we're seeing in the Bible. And I think that they're practical ways for us to do some things right away in our lives that are going to help detach us from our dependence on money. And the first one is this: ask God for joy, okay? Sounds simple, right? Ask God for joy, sounds simple, but here's what I mean. All too often, when we have a need, okay? When we have a need, we pray that God would meet the need. And I'm not telling you to stop praying that God would meet your needs, okay? But we pray, God, my car is broken. It needs to be fixed. Would you help me there? And we stop. God, I'm experiencing a change in my job, and it's gonna create a gap between my income and my needs. God, would you give me more money? And you know what? We go on and on and on about stories where God has provided for people in those ways. That's amazing. Okay, but don't stop with God, meet my need. God, give me joy where I am. I mean it with all sincerity. I'm guilty. I don't pray that prayer. I'm saying this. I'm preaching this to myself. Okay, I worry about what I'm not getting in life, and the God of the universe is offering me joy in the moment, in the circumstance, in spite of my need. He's offering it to me, and I don't ask for it. I don't ask for it. So the first thing I would just say is ask for joy. The second thing, definitely won't find this in the Bible, but trust me, don't upgrade. Can we just skip an upgrade once in a while? It's not wrong to upgrade, but we are caught, culturally, we are caught in a constant cycle of consumption. Just the next new thing. The next new thing after that. What's the new thing beyond that? This one does most of what I want, but the next one's really going to. I remember when my wife and I had this conversation. She asked if I wanted an iPod. This was, like 2004 or something. And I was like, no, because someday, I said no, I did my thing. But I said no, because someday they're going to put like an iPod in a phone. That's the one I want. I'd love to say it was all virtue, but it was just, no, it was me being like, I want the better thing. And look, again, it's not because getting an upgrade is sinful. That's not the point. But if we're going to make ground when it comes to our belief that wealth and possessions and stuff is going to satisfy us, we have to start breaking some cycles. And one key cycle that I think we need to break is the cycle of always needing the next new thing. The next version is it's 0.7% better. I've got to have it, right? I've got to have it. And the truth is, no, I don't. I don't got to have it. Just try it, okay? Just try it. Reset our minds. If we're going to do this, if we're going to renew our minds, we have to begin to reset our expectations for what stuff can do for us. Third, give some of your savings. If you got it. So the first one, that second one there, don't upgrade, was kind of a spending thing. This is more for you savers out there. Because look, if I have to choose my evils, I'll choose the saving. No, I won't personally, but I will tell you, like, yeah, saving's better than spending. I get it, okay? But here's the thing. For many savers in the room, we believe that we're going to cross a line. Not we. You believe, I can't do this one in first person. You believe that you're going to cross a threshold or a line where I now have saved enough, I've accumulated enough that I am secure. I have made it. I have enough. I am free from any danger befalling me. And I'm here to tell you the problem is that's a lie. It's a lie. Again, it's good to save. It's yes, but my point is, when our mindset is, I can save enough that I no longer need God, we're worshiping a false God. So here's what I'm just going to challenge you. If you're a saver in the room, find a project that you believe in. I would say a Christ-focused, gospel-centered project, and make a donation. I'm not even telling you give more here. You can do that if that's your project, but I'm just telling you, find something that God is doing in the world, a project that has financial need, and use some of your savings there. What are you saving for? To be secure? The author of Ecclesiastes says this is foolishness, right? It's foolishness. You can't take it with you. It's going to go on to those who, like, who knows how they're going to squander it. Use it. Use it. Give some of it. All right. Number four. Not only ask God for joy, but talk about your joy. Talk about your joy. I say this one because I love to tell people, like, how good a deal I got on my sneakers a couple weeks ago, and it was a really good deal. It was so good I bought two of them. Okay, but like not just like I'm not saying like we I love to talk about like this that great meal I had or like I love to tell those kinds of things, but do we talk about the things in life that actually brought us joy, that actually I experienced something in this that was different, it was meaningful, I got to keep going. But talk about it. Don't just pray for it when God gives you joy in it. Tell somebody else about it. Last one, delay buying. Okay, delay buying. even if you can afford it. Even if you can afford it. So I've been saving for whatever that item is, that big trip, the new car, whatever it is, I've been saving for it. Yeah, but maybe don't buy it. Not because it's wrong to buy it. I'm not here to tell you, like, if you buy that thing, you're sinning. That's not my point. Don't hear me say it. What I'm saying is we have attitudes in life that tell us, like, this is my money. And I have saved it. I've been responsible with it. And I can use it however I want. And what's the key word in that? I. It's mine. But every good gift just comes from God. It's really his. He gave it. What are we going to do with it? What are we going to do with what God has given us? If we're going to change our perspective, we have to begin to take some steps to do so. So look, we started today. I'm wrapping up. We started today with a song. There's a song, imagining the fun you could have with a windfall of $1 million. And it's a natural question. Like, people, I appreciate the fact that the teacher in Ecclesiastes, he goes back thousands of years. And he's saying, people then struggled with the same things we struggle with now. They thought money was going to give their life meaning. This is not a new question. It's an old question. But it is a natural question. It's a question that's common to us. How can I be happier? How can I be more secure? But we often answer the question that having more, accomplishing more, getting more is going to do it. But answering the question with money is sort of like the easy answer, right? Because money is quantifiable. It's quantifiable. It's easy to say, like, well, if I make this much, if I save this much, if I have this much, then I've made it. Okay? It's an easy answer. It may not be always easy to get our hands on those piles of cash. But it's easy to answer the question, what's going to make me happy, by more money. The difficult answer, honestly, is to choose joy. Resist money. Resisting money is hard, but it's the move of faith. It's the move of faith. It's the answer that walks by faith instead of by sight. The teacher in Ecclesiastes, he warns us to not trust in our money and our possessions. It's what he's doing. Don't trust in our money. Don't trust in what you can accumulate. But we have to, in order for us to actually heed that warning, we have to put our trust somewhere else. We have to move our trust from that to God. In order to do so, we have to take steps to resist the call of money in our lives. Okay? All right, I'm going to pray, and the band's going to come down. We're going to sing, and we're going to celebrate baptism with some people. Okay? All right, Father, we praise you this morning because we believe you are the giver of all good gifts. And I pray to confess to you, God, that I think if someone just watched my life, they wouldn't see that all the time. They'd see me chasing the things that we're warned about in Ecclesiastes. And so, God, I ask first for your forgiveness. Would you continue to show me more of who you are, show us more of who you are? Would you cause us to remember the times where you have provided for us? We believed we're going to be able to do it by our own strength, our own effort, but in the end, you're the one who provided. Father, we have to count on you. And so we love you and we thank you, and we pray all of this in your name, Jesus. Amen.
So good to be together today. Baptism is like my favorite day around here because it just reminds me of what we're about here at LCC. Again, pointing people to Jesus and others. If you would like to know more about what we do here at LCC, we have intro to LCC following the service. It's going to be a youth room that Dan is leading. If you're kind of new around here or just want to know our deepest values, join us there. And then something we also really care about is love and honor our community. So next week is the kickoff to our Hilliard Food Pantry food drive. Next Sunday after the service, grab a friend, grab a neighbor, grab someone in your group. We're going to distribute bags next Sunday after the service. And for more information on things we do around here, mylcc.info. Have a great day. So good to be with you all today.